John, thank you. Let me reciprocate to say what a great pleasure it was for us at the Institute for International Economics to work with you and all our colleagues at CSIS. This was a truly unique collaboration, and it was motivated by exactly what John said, the desire to bring some facts and clear analytical understanding to this series of complex and very contentious issues between China and the United States. Those issues will, of course, be highlighted by the visit this week of President Hu Jintao. We hope that our book will help provide a foundation for understanding the relationship, understanding the issues that are discussed in the visit, and thereby helping provide a basis for a sensible and constructive U.S. policy toward China, both in the discussions this week and going forward. There's one other element of the project that I would stress, in addition to its effort to provide a factual and analytical underpinning for understanding the relationship. That is the comprehensive nature of the book. It does try to pull together all dimensions of this very broad-based and very complicated relationship. The social issues, the political issues, the security issues, as well as the economic issues that we stress at our Institute for International Economics. I think it's fair to say this is the first effort to bring together all those very dimensions of the China rise issue, the relationships between China and the United States, into a comprehensive and hopefully intelligible set of relationships that can be understood and put into a consistent framework. So those were our goals. I wear two hats as a co-director with John Henry of the overall project, but also as one of the four co-authors. I want to speak most of the time for my three co-authors, but I want to start out by addressing just one issue, both because it is the centerpiece of the economic component of the discussion, therefore maybe of the discussions as a whole with President Hu Jintao this week, but also because it will illustrate what we tried to do in the book. What we tried to do, as I said, is straightforward facts analysis to improve understanding, and we particularly try to do that on the famous issue of the trade imbalance, which, as I say, is probably going to be at the centerpiece of at least the economic part of the discussion, maybe the discussions overall, certainly to the extent a lot of key members of Congress have anything to say with it, it will be. The trade deficit frames the overall economic aspect of the U.S.-China relation. It is well known that the bilateral deficit that the U.S. ran with China last year exceeded $200 billion. One of the things we say right up front in the book is, pay no attention to the bilateral imbalance. Bilateral imbalances are irrelevant in a world of multilateral trade, so one should not overemphasize that number, large and scary as it is. In this case, however, the bilateral imbalance does represent a reasonable approximation of the fact that the United States and China are on opposite sides of the big global multilateral imbalances, which people should indeed worry about. The United States in the fourth quarter of last year was running a global current account deficit of about $900 billion, about 7% of our economy. China last year ran a current account surplus of about $150 billion, almost as big as Japan for number one in the world, also about 7% of its economy. So in many respects, the United States and China are opposite sides of the big global imbalances, which do raise risks to international financial stability, because the dollar could crash any moment as a result, and also raise a big risk to trade politics. Because when the United States is running such huge trade deficits as it is now, that is always, throughout the last 50 years of history, a harbinger of protectionist trade politics. And you see it in the fact that the U.S. has already put on barriers to six major export sectors from China, that you have legislation like Schumer-Graham that would put an across-the-border tariff on Chinese exports to the U.S., passed the Congress 2-1 when it came to a test vote a year ago. The new, probably more important and serious Grassley-Baucus legislation, which would also try to tighten the administration's approach on China, particularly on the exchange rate, and apply meaningful sanctions as well if China continued to have a fundamentally misaligned or undervalued exchange rate. The fact that the U.S. is contemplating and to some extent already pursuing extensive trade protectionism against China at a time when our economy is so strong and we're close to full employment is, in my mind, a great worry. Because if our economy slows down, unemployment starts to go up, global trade deficits $1 trillion, then all hell could really break loose in terms of trade policy in this country, vis-a-vis China and the rest of the world. So these are the risks from the global imbalances. What we try to do in the book is explain why those imbalances exist and what should be done about them. One of the things we try to do in the book more broadly, across all issues, is to debunk myths. Where there are clearly fallacious views out there, where public understanding is erroneous, incorrect, simply based on either bad facts or bad analysis, we say that. And there's several cases in point here, as I will illustrate. At the same time, we try to call a spade a spade. Where there is a serious problem that needs to be addressed, we underline that, and in some cases, suggest some ways to go about it. So let me just very quickly tick off the five standard explanations for the big trade imbalances. Three of them we think are myths, one of them is an accurate explanation, and one of them requires action. The first one that we call a myth is actually a Chinese myth. The Chinese say, well, if you Americans would simply stop limiting your exports of high technology products to us, get rid of all those export controls, that would take care of the trade imbalance. Well, Nick Lardy ran the numbers, and it turns out that if the U.S. had approved every single export license for which approval was sought last year, it would have reduced the trade deficit by 0.3%. In other words, not much. Myth number one, to be debunked. Second argument, an American myth. Can't deal with those Chinese low wages. Unstoppable low-wage economy, they make a dollar a day. How could you possibly compete? Well, it's factually correct. Chinese wages are about 1/30 of American wages. However, as economists would normally think to be the case, Chinese productivity is also about 1/30 that of the United States. So when you correct the wage difference for the differences in output per worker, it washes out. If you want to have a macro view of that, just ask yourself, what about all those countries with lots lower wages than China? Do they export a lot to the United States? Most of them no. What about on the other end of the spectrum? The United States has among the highest wages in the world, but we're the second largest exporter. Who's the largest exporter? Germany. They have even higher wages. So you can't link wages to trade competitiveness. That would be fallacious. You have to bring in the productivity side. When you do it, that doesn't explain the imbalances. Myth number two, debunk. Third explanation, another American myth to be debunked, is because those Chinese control their markets for imports, they're mercantilists, they're protectionists, they block our trade. If only they'd open up, we could sell a lot more and the trade deficit would go away. Well, the truth is, China is one of the most open markets in the world. Sure, they still have some trade barriers, and we go into those in detail in the book and say they ought to be addressed. And they'll be discussed when President Hu Jintao is here this week, too. But in the aggregate, the share of imports in the Chinese economy is double that in the U.S. economy, triple that in Japan, three or four times that of India and many other big developing countries. In short, China is very open to trade. If you calculate, as Nick Lardy did, the actual customs payments by importers in China, compared with the value of imports, the ratio was about 2%. In a way, that's the measure of the effective tariff, 2%. If you look at their nominal applied tariffs, it's about 10%, but that's still much lower than any of the other big developing countries. And there are all sorts of other indicators of the extent to which China is truly an open economy. So it's a myth that we have a trade deficit because China blocks access to its market. Fourth explanation is the real one. China has become the assembly point of choice for economic integration throughout Asia. China has become the destination through which firms bring inputs from all over the world, but notably throughout the rest of Asia, Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Southeast Asia, even Japan to an increasing extent, bring product from all around, assemble it in China, and ship it around the world. Now, the way the statistics work, we then count the full value of those imports as coming from China. even though as much as two-thirds of the value added is not produced in China at all, but produced in other parts of the world. So when we look at the bilateral trade number with China, we really ought to think of it as U.S. trade with all of Asia. Indeed, when you look at U.S. trade with other parts of Asia, you will find a big reduction in our imbalance. We run a surplus now with Hong Kong, for example. If you look at the share that all these countries together represent in the U.S. trade deficit, it's actually declined over the last 10 to 20 years. The China share has gone up. The share of all the rest of the Asians has gone down. The totals remained about the same or down slightly. So again, it would be a mistake to think of it as a bilateral China problem. But it is then the accurate way to think about the U.S.-China relationship, see it as a proxy for U.S. economic relations and trade with all of East Asia as a whole. Fifth and final point, and this one is a serious issue. The imbalance that I just described, created in large part because China is the final assembly point, is exacerbated by one big policy error. And that is the Chinese error of maintaining their exchange rate at a price that is far, far lower than market forces and economic analysis would suggest is correct. How do we know that? Well, for the last 3 or 4 years, China has been intervening in the exchange markets every month to the tune of $15 to $20 billion to keep its exchange rate from rising. If China had a flexible exchange rate, like practically every other country in the world, this huge inflow of money, due to their trade surplus, due to foreign direct investment in China, due to speculation their currency is eventually going to go up, all that would have already pushed their currency up enormously in value. But the Chinese maintain a fixed peg to the dollar, despite the modest changes of last summer. That's what it still amounts to. So they intervene massively. Indeed, by the end of this year, they will have piled up foreign exchange reserves of about $1 trillion by doing so, by far the largest in the world, half their total economy, an incredible waste of resources, incidentally. But that has kept their currency cheap in the financial markets and given an added competitive advantage to Chinese products in world trade. And that has built on the structural element I just mentioned to exacerbate the imbalance and, going back to what I said we should keep our eye on, substantially increase this soaring global imbalance that China runs in its trade and current account position. So the big action issue in U.S. discussions with China over the last 3 years and increasing over the last few months has been the exchange rate issue. The United States, the G7, the IMF, quite rightly, have been suggesting to China that it needs to let its exchange rate go up in value. It doesn't have to go to a freely flowing exchange rate. Probably couldn't do that with the weakness of the banking system, but it could revalue the price upward, it could manage the float upward, any number of things they could do to achieve a correction in their current account position with the world as a whole, some of which would, of course, spill over to the U.S. The other key fact to keep in mind, and it goes back to China's being a kind of proxy for Asia as a whole, is that the other Asian current countries have been, understandably, unwilling to let their currencies go up against China, because that would hurt their competition against their main competitor. And therefore, since China pegs to the dollar, the other Asians, from Japan to India, have been unwilling to let their currencies go up against the dollar. And that means all of Asia, which accounts for more than half the world's surpluses, 90% of the big buildup in foreign exchange reserves, has been out of the international adjustment process. And that means that two things happen. One, that not much adjustment happens in the U.S. deficit, sorry. But when the dollar does go down, as it did considerably 2 or 3 years ago, it goes down against the euro, the Canadian dollar, the currencies of countries who are not in nearly as good shape as Asia to accept some correction in their trade position. So China's currency policy essentially excises all of Asia from the global adjustment process and exacerbates those financial and protectionist risks that I mentioned before. So in the book, going through those five sources of concern about China's trade policy, we debunk the first
first three myths, one China myth, two American myths. We then put heavy weight on the assembler of choice explanation, but add the currency policy error does need to be corrected decisively and soon to head off the threat of protectionism in the U.S. Congress, and I should say in Europe, and to help smooth the overall relationship and to have a successful outcome from the visit of President Fujitani. Okay, I'll quit. Turn to my colleagues. Bates Gill did chapter two of the book, which addresses where China is going internally. Dick Lardy did the elaboration on all the economic issues. Derek Mitchell did China's foreign policy and national security side, and we'll lay all that out for you.
Okay, thanks very much, Fred. I'm Bates Gill. I hold the Freeman Chair in China Studies at CSIS, and it's been a real honor and pleasure to work with Fred and Nick and Derek and all of our colleagues at IIE and CSIS in the completion of this project. China, the balance sheet, as Fred likes to say, with the modest subcaption, what the world needs to know now about the emerging superpower. In addition to this book here, we've also made available out there this briefing book, which I think might be very, very useful, especially to media and to others in Washington who are so pressed, it seems, for time, which tries to consolidate the book into about 31-page bullet point formatted summary of the key issues which we covered in this book, so I recommend that to you as well. This is an ongoing project. This is just the first of what we hope will be many products to emerge from this collaboration over the course of the next 2 to 3 years or longer. We would urge you to have a look at the newly established website for this project, which is www.chinabalancesheet.org. And there you will see even more in-depth information than could be provided in this relatively short book. And obviously it's a live, evolving site where we will continue to provide information, analyses, facts of all sorts and kinds over the course of the next 2 to 3 years and beyond. My task as part of this book's project was to take up the question of China's domestic social and political transformation. It's been my view over the recent years that if there's a blind spot, if you will, or if there's an empty space in the kind of attention that we've paid to China recently, it is that we have not devoted enough time to understanding what is going on inside the country, inside China. It's also my view that the China that we are going to deal with 10 or 15 years from now will be predominantly shaped and determined by what happens inside the country with regard to its domestic economy, with regard to its social development, with regard to its political reforms, more than the China that will be determined by how it externalizes itself. I think here in Washington, we tend to spend a lot of time being concerned about China as threat. You know, how does China externalize itself as an economic power, or as a military power, or as a political force? All very important issues. But we clearly need to spend a lot more time understanding what's going on inside China. This is what motivates the Chinese leadership, and this surely determines, in my mind, to a far greater extent than other factors, how China acts on the international scene. So if we don't understand what's going on inside the country, it's not going to help us in addressing both the opportunities and threats posed by the China challenge. So what I did in this chapter was to take up some of the key challenges which, some of the key challenges which we see the Chinese leadership facing, mostly laying it out on a factual and analytical basis, touching on such issues as rising social unrest and its causes in China, the problem of endemic corruption, especially at local levels amongst local officials, some of the certitudes of population and demographic trends, China becoming an older society, China becoming a society where the gender ratio is skewed to have more and more males in the society than what is a normal. China's challenges on its public welfare ledger, problems of providing decent health care, providing pension insurance, providing decent education to its citizens, especially in the poorer and more remote parts of the country. the problems that China faces with regard to its environment, increased environmental degradation, which is already having an impact in some parts of the country upon economic growth. And in the face of all these and other challenges, how is the Chinese Communist Party learning to adjust? What sort of measures are they choosing to take with regard to political reform, with regard to certain approaches, both positive and negative, to such questions as the emergence of non-governmental organizations, on issues of human rights, religious freedom, press freedom, and the rule of law? We conclude this chapter basically by arguing that we should, for better or worse, expect over the near to medium term, and by this I suppose we would mean 10 to 15 years, that we are likely to be dealing with the Chinese Communist Party in power in China over that term, at the very least, for better or for worse. That these problems do not add up yet to something that would lead to a collapse or dissolution of the Chinese state, nor does it strike us that it's likely to evolve in any near-term scenario towards Western-style liberal democratization, but rather through a combination of muddling through some minor adjustments toward reform, as well as a continued crackdown on signs of organized dissent, the Chinese Communist Party is likely to remain in place. That presents the United States with both good news and bad news. The bad news, clearly, is that to stay on top of this tiger, the Chinese Communist Party is likely to continue to resort to methods and means which run counter to American values and norms, especially with regard to dissent and the possibilities of problems arising from the media or from overly independent non-governmental organizations. So we're going to continue to have real problems on the human rights side with China. That doesn't seem likely to go away anytime soon. On the other hand, though, I think we should also point to some good news. The fact that Chinese leaders are going to be remain predominantly focused on domestic developments and dealing with the social and political challenges that they face, this strikes me as being good news, because it's going to mean it'll be less likely that the Chinese would be engaged in any forms of foreign adventurism. And it also feeds directly into their foreign policy, which is attempting to establish as much as possible at least constructive and stable relationships with virtually all of its neighbors, and especially with the United States. This concern with domestic problems very much motivates, I think, its attempt to portray itself internationally as engaging in a so-called peaceful development or peaceful rise. Other good news. I think the problems that China faces domestically present enormous opportunities for both public and private interests of the United States and others to provide various forms of assistance to Chinese localities, Chinese governments, to Chinese non-governmental organizations, to help the country deal with problems like the environment, to help them deal with the development of a more functional public health care system, to help them deal with the financial problems that they have and develop a viable financial markets. There's a host of opportunity. Environment is another great opportunity for American public and private interests to work in China to not only profit, but to make contributions which benefit not only China, but the United States as well. So we strongly encourage that there be indeed an intensification of efforts on the part of both public and private interests in the United States to help Chinese deal more effectively with the domestic, social, economic, and political problems that they face. Finally, and this where I'll segue over to Nick Lardy, we think also that it would be wise to help China deal more effectively with its domestic challenges, because that might be one way to get the Chinese to do more in stimulating their domestic economy. One way to help deal with the trade imbalances which we face with China would be for China to do more in the way of domestic investment, domestic development, domestic consumption, and less in the way of investing in export production. On that note, then, I'll turn over to Nick Clark.
Thank you, Bates. Thank you, Bates. I think the underlying reason one can talk today about China as a rising superpower, obviously, is its extraordinary growth performance over the last 2.5 decades. Since Deng Xiaoping brought China onto the reform path in the late 1970s, this economy has grown by about 10% per year. In terms of per capita output, the economy today is about 9 times what it was in the late 1970s. It's now the fourth largest economy in the world, the third largest trading economy in the world. So the growth performance has been very, very rapid and really has catapulted China onto the global stage. Now, despite that, the Chinese are now talking about some fundamental changes in their growth strategy, as Bates was alluding to. They have become concerned that their growth path has been driven primarily by rising rates of investment. Investment growth has been particularly rapid over the last 4 to 5 years, and also by the growth of its trade surplus. Trade surplus has become a major contributor to economic growth. On the other hand, consumption, that is, consumption by individuals, by households, has actually declined significantly as a share of the overall economy. In the 80s, it was more than half the economy. Today, it's under 40% of the economy. So the Chinese see a need to rebalance their economy and move more towards a consumption-driven growth path. And we analyze this in the book, in the chapter on the domestic economy, and we also trace its implications, if they were to do this, in the chapter on the international economy and China's role in the global economy. But let me just spend a minute or two explaining why the change. I think it's multiple in terms of its sources, but certainly you'd have to begin by recognizing that the efficiency of resource use has declined over the last decade as investment has risen to higher and higher levels. There's lots of evidence for this discussed in detail in the book. A second problem is a deteriorating environment, and Bates Hill does a very good job of analyzing that. But one of the underlying realities is when you're running a growth program that's based very heavily on investment, means you're producing lots of steel, lots of coal, things that tend to be very energy intensive and very polluting, and you're not producing as many consumer goods, which on average are much less energy intensive in production, much less polluting in production. So China, for example, last year used up about 2.2 billion tons of coal, more than twice as much as the next largest coal-consuming economy in the world. A third reason they want to switch their growth strategy is that they do recognize, as Fred said, when you start running huge global current account surpluses year after year after year, you do risk a backlash in terms of protectionist pressure in other markets. And they're certainly well aware of that. They've written openly about it, and we discuss that in the book. So it's kind of preventative action to get their growth less export dependent, less dependent on piling up trade surpluses of ever larger magnitude. And I think a final reason I'd point to, again, Bates has touched on this, there are very, very significant social needs in China that are going unmet. A very small portion of the population has any access to health insurance. Very few people have access to any kind of pension or social security. Education is expensive for people, particularly in poor areas of the countryside. And so China is falling behind, even as it's grown extremely rapidly, it's falling behind in terms of providing a social safety net for unemployed and so forth. So the government strategy is to severalfold. First, to cut taxes so that people have more money to spend. Secondly, to increase government consumption expenditures, not investment expenditures so much because they recognize they've gone a little bit overboard on that, but rather government consumption expenditures, by which we mean government-provided social services. So they've said, for example, that starting this year, they're going to cut fees for rural primary school education. They're going to increase certain other social expenditure programs to provide more services directly from the government. That will have the effect of raising household consumption, and also it will help to give people more households more confidence, and perhaps lead to a reduction in the saving rate in this economy. Fred mentioned at the outset that the United States and China are kind of mirror images of one another. We are running a 7% global current account deficit. China is running a roughly 7% global current account surplus. So we're polar opposites, the biggest deficit country and the biggest surplus country. We're also polar opposites in terms of our saving and investment behavior. China's consumption share of GDP is very low, but its savings share is very, very high. And put it at the household level, Chinese households are currently saving about 25% of their income. American households are actually dissaving. That is, they're spending more than their disposable income by going further and further into debt. China has the highest savings rate in the world. The United States has the lowest savings rate of any major economy in the world. So in terms of our internal domestic savings investment behavior, the two economies are in polar opposites. And what the Chinese leadership would like to do, obviously, is moving towards a more consumption-driven growth path, essentially means convincing people to save a little bit less and to spend more so the consumption share of GDP would go up and the savings rate of households would go down. Now, this is very difficult to engineer, and we certainly see the inverse in the United States, where people have been wringing their hands for years about the low savings rate of U.S. households, but it's very difficult to change household behavior. The Chinese hope that they will be able to change household behavior by providing more social services through the government and reducing the need to save to finance education, health, retirement, and so forth. But this will be a fairly long-term process, but one that we should welcome as they move in this direction. I should say that to tie back in to the theme that Fred was talking about, that kind of a change would also be very welcome from an international point of view, because if Chinese households were to save less and consume more, their imports would rise relative to their exports. They'd be less dependent on piling up larger and larger export surpluses. And so that would be a contribution to reducing global economic imbalances. So I guess I would say, in summary, the growth has been fantastic, but perhaps not sustainable. It's been too damaging to the environment. It has depended too much on higher and higher rates of investment, and too much, particularly in the last 2 or 3 years, in accumulating very large trade surpluses, export surpluses. The leadership has recognized the shortcomings of the strategy, the path they've been on, and are beginning to talk about changing it, stimulating domestic consumption, reining in investment demand, and undertaking policy changes that would lead to smaller external surpluses on a global basis. I think this would be highly desirable, both from China's point of view. It would help them to meet a lot of unmet social needs. It would also be highly desirable from a global point of view, because it would reflect China's making a significant contribution to the reduction of global economic imbalances, which are one of the major risks to the global economy. But I would say this is not going to happen fast. All the evidence is that investment is still rising very rapidly. They've been unwilling to change their exchange rate, which was often this adjustment process, as Fred indicated. They're unable to raise interest rates to curtail the rate of investment. So there's a talk about a shift towards a consumption-driven growth path, but not very much evidence yet that it is actually emerging, and I think that's going to be one of the most important things to watch over the next year or so. And with that, I'll turn it over to Derek to talk about foreign policy and security.
Thanks very much, Nick. My name is Derek Mitchell. I'm a senior fellow at the International Security Program at CSIS. I did, as suggested, the foreign and security policy section of the book. Let me say first, I want to echo thanks that John Hamry made to Carolyn McGifford, who was the executive director of this program, put together the website as well with Chidij Bajpai, who was my research associate at CSIS. The website, again, for those who tuned in late, is www.chinabalancesheet.org, where you can get not only parts of the book, but also single pages on individual topics. My section, and even on this panel, I come fourth. In the book, I think technically it's fifth. And no one likes to come last. No one likes to be fourth or fifth. But
Clean-up slot. Clean-up slot.
Well, that's true.
Clean-up slot.
Cleaner, yes. But it is logical in this case. Certainly we do not take any offense at that, because, in fact, foreign security policy, as I discuss it, and I think as it is, I think in China, is a function of the domestic concerns that China has right now. that the way it deals with the world is largely the way it views its priorities, which is to deal with, as Bates discussed, its tremendous domestic challenges. Across the board, whether it's environmental degradation, civic unrest, social cohesion, etc., they are focused like a laser on the domestic stability. Their foreign policy, I suggest, is largely based on defense, at least in the short and medium term. The idea that they need a peaceful international environment, the idea that they need a peaceful periphery, the nations around the country, they need good relations there. They want to make sure they have a good relationship with their major market, the United States, the superpower that can really complicate their efforts to focus inward. This is how they're viewing the international environment, and I think informs the way they're dealing with their foreign policy as a whole. Of course, to keep that domestic engine running, they need tremendous amounts of natural resources and energy. So they're going around the world looking desperately for any sources of natural resources, and particularly oil, natural gas. I think it's in the headlines in the news, but you'll see they're going to Sudan. They're complicating our efforts to isolate Sudan, to deal with the Iranian problem. They're working in Burma. They're working in Zimbabwe, Venezuela, a lot of places that the United States is trying to deal with in other ways, either isolate or trying to protect certain international norms. China has a kind of amoral, perhaps, or at least an unconditional engagement with the world that is complicating the United States and its foreign policy, and I would argue is complicating the international system to a degree. While China, I think, does not want to change the international system in the near term, they like the stability of the current system, the UN system, etc., their actions could undermine it simply because they are unconditionally dealing with nations that are violating certain norms and values. That is what Bob Zoellick talks about when he talks about a responsible stakeholder in the international system. That we want to work with China as a partner to make sure they're dealing responsibly according to these norms, but the dialogue so far has not been entirely productive along those lines. Of course, I think the Chinese will probably have questions about our responsible stakeholder values in the international system as well, and that's why you have summits, and that's why you have dialogue, which we do have. Another aspect of their foreign policy, of course, is Taiwan. This is another central pillar of regime legitimacy. One is, of course, economic development, keeping stability at home. The second is trying to facilitate the reintegration, reunification, whatever you may want to call it, of Taiwan. And that means internationally trying to isolate Taiwan, trying to make sure they don't get enough political space, at least under current conditions, so that they feel comfortable in the current situation, and also trying to prevent the United States from giving enough support for Taiwan that they feel they might be able to move towards formal permanent separation, if not independence. And I think, as I say in the book, that China feels that time is on its side when it comes to Taiwan generally. So in the near term, I don't think China is looking to necessarily push for independence, but I think they feel a bit worried about the Taiwan government's moves towards independence. I'm sorry, but China does not want unification in the near term. They want to prevent independence, at least in the near term, so that, again, they can focus internally and not deal with the complications that would provide for them. Now, at the same time, as you look at China around the world, they are taking opportunities to increase their influence. I call this in the book strategic opportunism, that where the United States does provide opportunities for them, they provide a vacuum to Western isolate certain regimes, China will go in and seek to promote their own interests. China still talks about themselves as the largest developing country, and talk about the leadership in the developing world, kind of a South-South kind of unity. They still call for a multipolar world, which is obviously a code word for opposing the United States' unipolar environment. And again, I think they feel very patient in this regard. They're not pushing this too openly, too aggressively right now. But again, I think they feel time might be on their side, but they're looking more in the 20 to 30 year time frame. So all in all, I think the U.S. and China are kind of hedging their bets against each other. The essential element of U.S. approach to China is the uncertainty of the future of China. We don't know how China is going to develop. We don't know if they will continue on a stable path. We don't know, as they modernize their military, which we're very concerned about, whether they will be more aggressive, more assertive in their international engagement. So the Pentagon, of course, is looking very seriously at the the potential challenges of a strong China 20, 30 years from now, even as our State Department and White House, I think, are trying to deal, working for the best in partnership with China as they can, but again, preparing for the worst should it happen. And the same goes for China. The essential mistrust of the United States, whether the United States is seeking to maintain China, again, this issue of stability, domestic stability in China, and the connection to what's happening, say, in Kyrgyzstan, in Uzbekistan, and I would argue even in Nepal. And you see the headlines now in Nepal, the youthful demonstrations in the streets. It's got to concern the Chinese right across the border about whether China can withstand the kinds of pressures on their border where there are grassroots developments. They think the United States may have a little bit of a role in this whole democracy promotion. So they mistrust the United States as well. And this transitional period is very delicate. That's why summits like this current week's summit and continuing dialogue, which occurs on a more regular basis between the two sides, is very critical. Leads to what I view as very complex views of each other. Hopefully not hostile views of each other, but very complex and very uncertain views. And hopefully this book, again, provides a comprehensive look at those complexities.
I want to thank our authors for fascinating presentations. And I know that everyone here wants to get to some questions, so we'll take some Q&A right about now. Chris.
I guess, regarding the currency, you talked about the imbalances that are exacerbated by China's currency policies, and I just wanted to ask, given that many people criticize the Schumer-Graham approach of tariffs, is jawboning enough, or what else should the United States be doing, and particularly with this upcoming summit, to try to get China to change its currency policy?
Well, the chosen instrument in the international system for dealing with problems of that type is the International Monetary Fund. And the IMF has some pretty clear rules about national behavior on exchange rates. The IMF has a firm rule, for example, thou shalt not maintain a competitively undervalued currency to promote your trade competitiveness and run big surpluses. Thou shalt not conduct prolonged, large-scale, one-way intervention in the currency markets to keep your exchange rate out of line. So the IMF has clear rules, and participants in the multilateral system are required to follow those rules. The problem is that the IMF has not been very active in trying to make sure those rules are implemented over time, not just in the current case. Only a couple of countries have ever been called on the carpet under those provisions. And the IMF has done very little in the current context to put the pressure on China. That partly reflects a real problem, which is that when a country is a surplus country and doesn't need lending, and in fact is the lender itself, not the recipient of credit, it's hard for other people to really put meaningful pressure on it. So there is a disconnect. And the de facto result is that when problems of this type become acute, as they have 20 years ago, 30 years ago, in earlier periods of the history of the world economy, the U.S., particularly the U.S. Congress, tends to move toward taking matters into its own hands. And you therefore get something like the Schumer-Graham Initiative, or, as I mentioned, what I would regard as much more responsible because less extreme, Grassley-Baucus Initiative that was introduced just 2 weeks ago. As I say, you want multilateral approaches to global problems of this type, but if you can't do that, as in some other areas, the U.S. as the putative leader of the global system does tend to come into the act. The administration, of course, has been urging the Chinese to take steps in order to head off extreme actions by the Congress. Chinese made a very minor move last summer, very little action under that since that time. So as Nick said, when we talked about changes in the thrust of their domestic economy, which would move in the same and right direction, there's been a lot of talk, but not much action. And as I've at least been testifying to Congress lately, talking to a number of leading congressmen and administration officials, as we have been briefing on this new book, I've been deeply concerned at the degree of frustration and impatience at the absence of concrete action by the Chinese in an area where they clearly could help. So my concern is that if President Hu comes and goes without any serious action on this front, one could easily see some significant pushback evolving in the Congress. The administration may feel it has to label China as a currency manipulator under current law, and all that could push in a very unconstructive direction in terms of economic relations between the country and for the world system as a whole.
I'm Tom Reckford with the World Affairs Council. Bates, in your remarks, you referred to endemic corruption. I wonder if you would like to elaborate a bit on the issue. For example, what impact is it having on the social unrest that we're seeing in the villages and towns around the country, land grab issues, for example? And how seriously is the party taking the problem? I know that there are periodic efforts to slap people in jail. Is it only for opponents of the regime? Are they willing to make a serious effort to decrease corruption? And maybe for Nick, to what extent does this actually lead to significant distortions in the economy?
Thanks very much, Tom. I'll refer everyone here to the book itself to get into some of the nitty-gritty detail. We lay out a lot of facts and figures about China's ranking internationally, according to Transparency International, for example, puts it at 78 out of about 158 countries in terms of the level of corruption. Some interesting things to think about, though, maybe just to put it a little more in context. We're not talking about sort of Zimbabwe-like thievery at the highest levels, basically shoveling money out of the country and into Swiss bank accounts for the benefits of the top one or two leaders of the country. That's not the sort of corruption that we're talking about here. In China, as far as we can tell, I think, looking at it as an outsider, you don't see that kind of corruption taking place at among the senior leaders of China. Surely there is, as there are in a lot of countries, issues of nepotism and so forth for the sons and daughters of Chinese leaders, but nothing on the scale that you see in other parts of the world in terms of corruption at that level. Where it occurs is really at lower local levels, where increasingly officials are more and more independent of central mandates, and are more capable of exercising their authority beyond the reach, so to speak, of central authorities. The central government has made very clear in identifying corruption as its single most crucial problem to deal with. Wen Jiabao, for example, is on record and openly stating that if they don't get this corruption thing right, it's curtains for the party. So it's not as if they're ignoring it at the central level. That's an important thing. At least they identify it as a problem and are trying to deal with it. Now, the question you ask is, you know, how hard are they really trying? And that's where the problem lies. Because what we're talking about is corruption amongst officials. So to the degree that you wish to attack this problem, at some point it becomes an attack on the party itself rather than individuals, because it is so endemic. It does arise from the fact that only 5% of the country are Communist Party members, and they're basically unaccountable and unelected. And that under those sorts of conditions, especially at a time of rapid socioeconomic transformation, the gaps and opportunities that arise for officials at lower levels to cheat and to line their pockets are considerable. So while there are a lot of high-profile campaigns of various sorts, it strikes me that they've done very little to really root it out. And it has increasingly led, in certain cases, as a source of some social unrest, for example, when local officials are in cahoots with local developers, and for kickbacks are allowed to, the developers are allowed to move in and move some pickets off the land for the construction of a factory or some other real estate development. This sort of thing is going on a lot, and it has resulted in as a major source for some of the unrest that we see in China. Conclusion, though, that I would add, I don't know if Nick would agree with this entirely, but I mean, so far, at least, this does not seem to have a major dent on China's economic growth prospects at this point. Maybe turn over to Nick and see if he has some thoughts on
that. Yeah, Tom, in response to your question, I think the major area where we see a distortion as a result of corruption really is in real estate and property development. This is a society, after all, where the state claims to be the ultimate owner of property, and the process by which land is allocated to develop apartment houses or commercial space or offices or whatever is extremely untransparent. And the people who control that allocation process, in many cases, have become fabulously wealthy. And so the whole nature of the property sector, I would say, has been a distortion. There's been too much investment in property. It's been an extraordinarily lucrative sector because people in the right place at the right time have been able to get access to property at below market prices and then profit enormously from it. You see it obviously in income distribution figures. China's gone from being a very relatively egalitarian society, I should say, to a much, much less egalitarian society, one of the most unequal societies on the globe. And we don't have a good number, but a very substantial portion of wealth at the apex of the system has been generated in the property sector, and frequently, not always, but frequently, because of corruption in the way that land has been allocated. I do think it's a corrosive influence. Hasn't affected lots of other parts of the economy. The property sector is clearly
Yeah.
Yeah.
Paramiswaran from Agence France-Presse. Considering the fact that the United States has used the WTO as a mechanism to address its trade problems with China, why didn't the U.S. go full steam ahead with the IMF, for instance, or the international community to regulate or to bring reforms to the global currency scheme? The fact that the currency crisis in Asia, for example, 1997, resulted in many of these Asian economies dismantling their pegs to the U.S. dollar or the fixed links to the U.S. dollar. And China at that time basically stood very firmly and didn't break its peg to the U.S. dollar despite tremendous pressure.
Well, the 1997-98 crisis, of course, illustrates the difference with the current situation with China and the other Asian surplus countries. That was a period, of course, where the Asian countries were running huge deficits, had to attract large amounts of foreign loans, and the IMF was thus in a very strong position to orchestrate the response. Now, there's ongoing debate, of course, whether the IMF did that very effectively. But the point was the Asian countries were dependent on receiving foreign lending, foreign bailouts, essentially, to avoid even deeper crises. So the IMF was in a strong position to act. By contrast, we're now talking about the flip side of the coin, where China has a huge surplus. Most of the other Asian countries have also been piling up very large surpluses. Indeed, as I said, they've been intervening in the currency markets to propagate those surpluses. But since, to put it mildly, they don't need credit, indeed, they're extending credit to their deficit counterparts, like the United States, the IMF has very limited leverage. And so that dominates the overall picture. Now, even having said that, I think the United States, particularly over the last 6 months or so, has tried to mobilize the IMF to get into the front ranks of this effort. But there have been two problems, to be very candid. Three problems. One is the IMF institutionally does not have a dispute settlement mechanism like the WTO. In the WTO, you can bring a case that claims that a country violates its obligations under a certain provision, and you can get an up or down decision. Actually, it's been revolutionary that the world has agreed to that, because countries, including the United States, have subrogated their sovereignty in a certain way to the WTO and said, we'll take a multilateral judgment as to whether we're in compliance with our international rules. The IMF does not have that. You can't bring a case to a dispute settlement mechanism under the IMF. There probably ought to be, but there's not, and so that's a huge structural difference. Beyond that, politically,
the other lead members of the IMF, particularly in Europe, have really been unwilling to support a strong IMF push on China and the other Asians. You could argue about the motivations for that, hiding behind the U.S. or simple commercial competition. We don't want to rile Beijing. We're trying to sell them Airbuses. There are any number of motives you could adduce. But the fact of the matter is that the lead countries in the IMF have not been on board to mobilize the IMF, take a big initiative here. And the U.S. doesn't dominate the IMF. The U.S. can veto some decisions, but it cannot unilaterally generate a majority. It has to persuade people. And since the other main players have not been willing, the IMF has not been so active in the case, despite a U.S. effort to get it there. And that is why, to repeat what I said before, I worry, and I think it's an increasing worry, that the United States and some others, including Europe, will want to take matters into their own hands. And as China's surplus continues to grow, and as the sense of its unfairness and achieving additional competitive advantage through growing undervaluation of currency becomes widespread, the risk that there will be a protectionist backlash in both the United States and Europe, I stress, and Europe, not just the United States, is quite a severe risk. So the bottom line is that this financial imbalance could cause a severe bust-up in the global trading system. And that's the risk that I think we face at this moment.
Dan Rosen, McClatchy Newspapers. I was wondering how big of a role you all think the Iran dispute slash crisis will play in this meeting between the two presidents. It seems to me that China and the United States at similar points in time are closer together on Iran than they were on Iraq. I'd like you to comment on whether you think that's true and just how much this issue will dominate.
China, we're not going to invade Iran tomorrow, I don't think. And that's where the main difference comes. We're taking a more diplomatic approach, a patient approach. We want to take it to the UN Security Council, which is normally what China approves of, what they would prefer, the unilateralism. So in that way, in the process, China's closer to us than they were to us over the Iraq issue. This will have a high profile at the summit, but it's one of many, many issues that are of great importance to us at the summit, frankly. I mean, North Korea is another one where we want China to bring North Korea to the table. All these economic issues, the president has to be seen as taking a very high profile pressure to China. Human rights and religious freedom as well are issues that the president feels personally about. So Iran should be a major issue. It will be brought up. But I sense that we have more problems with Russia than we do with China right now. That China follows Russia on this. That China's sending envoys seeking to bring Iran along. We're frustrated, of course, that they're not backing us entirely. That they want to bring it to the IAEA instead of the UN Security Council for action. As I say in the book, China's always rather loath to bring anything to the UN Security Council for sanctions action. China knows it's in a glass house. It doesn't like sanctions generally. It doesn't want to be on record, certainly, of having to vote for or against any action against Iran, where it has 17% of its oil comes from Iran. It has economic interests with Iran. It doesn't want to be on record at all of hurting that relationship. So they want to stay somewhat on the fence, keep on the high road, at least, of promoting dialogue. So I'm sure they'll say to the U.S. in return, you have to be patient. You have to continue this path. Let's see what the IAEA report says, which I think now comes out in June. We have time. All the reports suggest putting a nuclear weapon maybe years off. So yes, we will want to get China to be more on our side when it comes to eventually going to the UN. We'll press them on this, but I don't think this is going to be a make or break issue of the summit, all in all, given that they feel the time, the Bush administration feels time. There is some time in this regard.
U.S. China Education Trust. I want to follow up on the property issue. I guess it's either for Bates or Nick. What do you think of the recent National Health Congress failure to pass the private property legislation? What do you think of the implications, both politically and economically?
I'll just make a quick comment on that. I thought it was a fascinating development. I was in China at the time, and I was out in a village, actually, north of Beijing, and was speaking with some of the villagers who were very keen to have this law go forward. In fact, there were some places were expanding the footprint of their house because the law, as they understood it, was going to allow ownership, quote unquote, of whatever land you had your house on. So therefore, build a bigger house so you could have one. So I think people have very high expectations, and it was looked forward to by a lot. I read it as an interesting political problem, I guess you'd say, that the Communist Party is facing. Some concerns about going too far, too fast down this, what do you want to call it, marketizing road. There's some interesting interpretations about whether there aren't some emerging schisms within the party about the best development path to take and to maybe bring a halt or bring at least slow down some of this movement towards the market that has some people worried that that's going to ultimately undermine or could ultimately undermine the authority of the party. Or, to put a nicer spin on it, by going down this path, it may lead to further dislocation for the less fortunate in China, the poorer urban and rural workers who can't as readily take advantage of a more rapid move to the market. Either way, you want to interpret it in that sort of benign sense, or whether you want to be more cynical and see it as a reining in so that the party doesn't lose complete control over the social economic situation in China. It's an interesting development, and I think it reminds us of the importance to be looking inside the country and trying to parse out what are really some very, very fascinating political and economic debates in the country about the future.
Well, I'll just add a footnote. The debate may be about, at least externally or openly, about whether or not the market has gone too far, but the real issue is the rents that party controls through its ability to allocate land, as I said before, on a non-transparent basis. So basically, this kind of a reform has the potential to very substantially reduce the amount of corruption, ill-gotten gains by those who are in a good position to control the allocation of land. I think it's a pure, it's kind of a power struggle within the party. The people that are in charge of that don't want to give it up, so they couch the argument in terms of we're going too far down the market road. We need to maintain some of the traditional system. What they really want to have is an ability to continue to generate huge amounts of wealth.
Now, Mike means I have a question about the U.S.-India nuclear deal that was signed in March from the president visited India. You know, several changes have to be made in U.S. domestic law or international arrangement before this deal can be actually implemented. And one of them is, of course, the endorsement of the nuclear supplier group, and China is one of those countries in the group. My question is very simple. Do you think China will endorse the U.S. arrangement, the U.S. export of nuclear materials, equipment, technology to India as a member of the nuclear supplier group, and why?
We don't talk about that in the book, but it's the issue of U.S.-India relations and China-India relations is a very important one. It's going to be more and more critical to look at that in years ahead. My sense is China is going to accommodate this ultimately. And they have, at first, they were silent about it. And there were rumblings that they were going to give some nuclear equipment and fuel and such to Pakistan. They're going to help use that as a kind of balance in a great game in South Asia, etc. But China wants to have a good relationship with India as well. they don't want to be the ones blocking such a thing. They don't want to be seen as hostile to India's peaceful nuclear development either. So they have said that they could support it, they don't oppose it, but they want it to be in conformity with the non-proliferation treaty, with international non-proliferation norms, which a lot of Americans are saying the same thing. So they're taking somewhat of a high road and saying, if we can keep it consistent with international norms and we can go along. I suspect that they'll try and get certain concessions out of India that we are now. India is talking to the IAEA about agreeing to certain safeguards and such. And that ultimately China will make a political decision. They'll finesse it and won't block it. As I say also in the book, China is a country that does not want to be isolated in a position. They don't want to be the single country sticking out on something, an obstacle. They like to hide behind Russia normally when it comes to Iran or other issues. And that's much easier to stay quiet, as they did in Iraq as well. They were not loud about Iraq. They quietly opposed it, but they were not out front. So I think in the India situation as well, the international community, the other nations, nuclear suppliers group go along with it, that China will either abstain or do what's necessary in order to allow it to go through and safeguard that China-India relationship that they will need in order to balance an increasing U.S.-India relationship.
Thank you. Christopher Gaber at BNA. Just given President Hu's visit, I thought maybe an overall question, if several of you might want to comment on how the administration has handled the China relationship. Particularly on trade, there are certainly some who might argue that the administration has been too easy. They've only once or, I guess now twice, taken China to the WTO. They haven't done a case on intellectual property rights, which many in Congress have pushed for a long time. They haven't cited China as a currency manipulator in the Treasury report, even though they've come very close. Some then might also argue that the Schumer-Graham bill has sort of been a more, perhaps even more effective sort of bad cop mechanism. I'm wondering if you guys think, you know, has the Bush administration been too easy on China and not pushed them enough? And if so, or even if not, I mean, has Schumer-Graham been in some way, I mean, given your criticism of China's currency policy, has Schumer-Graham maybe been at least effective in getting China to move a little more than they might have otherwise? Thank you.
Let me start out. One of the things, first of all, I don't want to comment specifically about whether or not Bush has done everything exactly right, but I think one of the themes that comes through, particularly in the economics chapters, is to try to recognize the limits of U.S. policy in these domains. The administration simply does not have very many policy instruments. Let me just take a couple. You mentioned IPR. Well, we point out one of the big problems in IPR is most of the companies that complain about IPR don't want to provide the information that is necessary to file a successful case. They want to hide behind their trade associations and do other things like that. They're worried about retaliation by the Chinese, whether or not that's valid. I don't have any idea. But that's the first problem with the IPR. The second problem with IPR that we point out is that there are no standards for enforcement of intellectual property in the documents that set forth the International Agreement on Intellectual Property, the so-called TRIPS. There are no standards for enforcement. So to go in and file a case and say you're not adequately enforcing what you've signed up for is not likely to be a successful case. No country has ever won such a case. So in the area of intellectual property, we've negotiated for a long time. I think we've made some progress. It's frustrating, it's slow, but I don't think that we have a lot of tools. The U.S. has a lot of tools at its disposal to work more aggressively. On the currency, in reality is, if we were to name China a currency manipulator, you know, I certainly think they're a manipulator. Any country that piles up $200 billion a year, 3 years in a row, that has the second biggest global current account surplus in the world, it seems fairly obvious that they're a manipulator. But, you know, even if you name them a manipulator, I would argue there aren't really very many practical consequences. It requires the Treasury to enter into formal negotiations on the issue with the Chinese, but they've been in negotiations on this issue for more than 2 years. So, the Chinese should move. I think it's in their interest to move for a whole series of reasons, many of which we haven't gone into, although we do discuss them in the book. But I don't think we have very much leverage. And part of what you see in Congress is a reaction to the fact that the administration doesn't have very many tools. Senator Schumer frequently says he introduced his bill to give the administration more leverage. You know, whether or not it did, I think it's debatable. But I think one of the things that we do stress in the book is that we don't always have exactly the policy instruments that we'd like to have in order to advance some of these issues. We have to be more realistic about what our leverage is.
And let me just add one word on that on the economic side. You asked about shoot and ramp. I think it has added somewhat to the administration's leverage, but it is recognized to be such an extreme step that the credibility thereof is probably not too great. If the U.S. were ever to implement the Schumer-Graham legislation, it would, of course, blatantly violate our own WTO obligation by singling out an individual country for discriminatory treatment, and the Chinese could legitimately, under their WTO right, retaliate against us. And a trade war would break out between the two most dynamic economies, and nobody really wants that. So it's been kind of like a nuclear threat, making something out of brandishing it, but you certainly never want to use it. That's why I believe the new Grassley-Baucus legislation brings a whole new dimension to the issue, because this is a much more serious and measured piece of legislation. On the one hand, it would dramatically improve the current legislation governing the whole exchange rate area. Instead of dealing with this fuzzy question of manipulation, which gets to intent, it would address the issue of fundamental misalignment in currency. And as Nick said, it's obvious that the Chinese currency is grossly undervalued. That would be a no-brainer. And the second thing about Grassley-Baucus is that it puts in place some more measured but still significant sanctions. For example, if Grassley-Baucus were to become law and the administration were to designate China as in fundamental misalignment of the currency under it, the administration would be unable to shift China from non-market to market economy status, something that the Chinese devoutly wish because of its implication for the way you implement any dumping laws, countervailing duty laws, etc. As China has gone around the world in its commercial diplomacy in recent years, negotiating free trade agreements with some countries like Australia, New Zealand, doing raw materials deals like with Brazil, Argentina, the first thing it has insisted from every partner is the designation of market economy status. They want it badly, and they particularly want it from the United States. This legislation would bar it. In addition, the legislation would bar the U.S. from supporting an increase in the Chinese quota at the IMF. Well, that may sound technical and arcane, it's probably not at the top of the Chinese wish list, but they do believe correctly that as the world's third, fourth largest economy, third largest trader, they should play a much bigger role in the IMF. In the book, we address that. We agree they should. But you're only going to get that kind of support if they are faithfully carrying out their own obligations to the IMF. This legislation would bar the U.S. from voting for it, and this is an issue where the U.S. can veto, because increases in quotas require a weighted majority of 85%. The U.S. has 17% of the vote. The U.S. could veto it. So if this bill goes through, and the managing director of the IMF, as he intends to do, proposes a quota increase for China later this year, the U.S. would be required to veto it. And that would bring the issue front and center. So I think it's serious legislation. It has some bite. It's more sensible in its underlying premise. And I think it begins to change the metric. When some of you probably covered that, when the legislation was introduced 3 weeks ago, I testified that morning in the first panel with administration witnesses. Senator Baucus asked the Treasury Undersecretary Ken Adams, would this give you more tools? And Adams said, yes, Senator, it would give us more tools to carry out our campaign. He didn't endorse the legislation. It had just been introduced. They didn't take a formal position. But he acknowledged that. And since I used to be in that job and know that you don't have very many tools in dealing with surplus countries that are piling up reserves, I can endorse what he said. It would give more tools and in a more responsible way. So, again, what I said before, the president who comes and goes, no progress is made on these issues. China continues to resist cooperating on this fairly obvious set of topics where global economic risks are at play. I'm afraid we may get more movement by the Congress to take matters into its own hands, and the administration may feel that it's compelled to go along.
Let me just
add one word to this. I mean, I think this past year has been very, very interesting in terms of China relations, and President Hu's arriving as sort of a culminating point, I would say. And we are at an important turning point, not only on the economic issues, but you look at some of the other questions that they're going to be dealing with, notably with regard to North Korea and with regard to Iran. I think expectations have built up over the past year as Congress has increasingly recognized the importance of China as they formed these various working groups up on Capitol Hill to try and dig into the issue more deeply. As Bob Zelik has launched the Responsible Stakeholder and Senior Leaders Dialogue effort with the Chinese, I think we're getting to a point now, and this is President Hu's first visit to Washington as the leader of China. I think the expectations are relatively high, although in a quiet way, on the part of our administration and Congress, that Hu not come and go without saying or doing anything on a range of issues. And if he doesn't, not only on the economic side, but on security side, and as we move into a midterm election and then the wide open presidential election of 2008, I think China does risk becoming the target of a great deal more frustration on economic and security questions going forward.
Can I just add one thing, goes back to the earlier question about how the administration handled the relationship. Mm-hmm. I think there's an irony surrounding the upcoming summit. Derek made very clear, stressed throughout the book, that China wants to conduct a kind of non-controversial foreign policy. It wants good relations with the U.S. and the major countries, so it'll be left alone to do things at home. Doing things at home basically means maintaining rapid economic growth, because that deals with the social problem, and that's the source of the legitimacy at this point of the Communist Party. The irony is that China's own economic policy may lead to the kind of pushback and even backlash we're talking about here that would then cloud the overall U.S.-China relationship and make it harder for the Chinese to achieve the kind of benign overall international posture, notably with the United States, that they would like. And so the stakes in dealing with the economic issues really go beyond just the economics. The economics of it is important. But it's now to a point where dealing with the economics, I think, and we're all saying that, is essential in terms of the overall relationship. 2 years ago, my suspicion was that the administration was kind of keeping the lid on the economic issues in order to avoid deflecting from their priority on North Korea or anti-terror, whatever it may have been. Now it's almost flipped around, and as we've talked to people in the administration, there's a recognition that if the economic issues go off the rails, some of this legislation were to pass, it could cloud the overall relationship and make it harder to do the security thing. So there's almost been a role reversal here, and there's a kind of irony, I think, surrounding the visit of President Hu, which we hope, including to our book, to convey not only to the U.S. audience, but the Chinese audience, and pave the way for constructive steps forward to avoid those kinds of problems.
I'm Mike Fonte. I'm the Washington liaison for the Democratic Progressive Party of Taiwan. In the book, you point out very clearly that the One China principle of China, which calls for peaceful reunification, sees sovereignty as indivisible. The sovereignty of China is indivisible, and Taiwan's got to be part of that reunification process, whereas our One China policy, that is the United States One China policy, sees sovereignty as undetermined in terms of Taiwan, and we remain, as you say in here, agnostic on the outcome. It's up to both sides mutually accept to come to some peaceful, acceptable resolution. So I guess the question is, at the summit, do you think there'll be much conversation about Taiwan's democracy? President Bush made a very big point in his Kyoto speech of Taiwan's democracy. I wonder how you see that, both short term here in the summit, and also longer term playing out in U.S.-China relations.
Well, I don't know what he'll say in his talking points regarding Taiwan democracy necessarily, but we have the same ritual talking points we always give on this, which is we adhere to the three communiques, the Taiwan Relations Act, maintenance of the status quo, no change of the status quo. That's not acceptable to both sides, and that kind of thing, peaceful resolution. It's those basic talking points. I don't think the president will go too too much further than that, he may raise, in that context, the issue of China's military modernization and the military threat to Taiwan and the need of unconditional dialogue with the leadership in Taipei. That's another part of the talking points as well that we do at least privately and to the publicly. In the next month, the Defense Department's going to put out its annual report on Chinese military power. In there, it's going to reiterate American concerns and others' concerns about China's transparency of its military development. And in the context of Taiwan, this is critical because the sense is that the more it's militarized, the more Taiwan feels like it's being coerced or under threat, the less it might want to engage in real discussions, and it also creates bad faith across the strait, and perhaps that is not a good environment for discussion. So perhaps the president will say that. I don't think our side is going to raise this. Typically, we have our list of things, and then China says, oh, by the way, Taiwan, which is always the center of whatever the talking points of a Chinese president or any Chinese leader or Chinese scholar or anyone dealing with Chinese foreign policy when they meet Americans. So, you know, I'm sure Hu Jintao will reiterate the statement he made to Lian Zhen the other day in Beijing about wanting to have dialogue, demonstrating that it is operating in good faith, but I don't foresee any real change in talking points of either side, any progress at all, just a reiteration of the concerns that we've had for at least 10, 15, if not 30 or 50 years in this regard. Yeah.
There's an interesting passage in the book that says China's interest in stability trumps its commitment to a nuclear weapons-free peninsula or regime change in North Korea. President Bush has labeled North Korea one of the axis of equal countries. Is this, should I infer from this that we can expect no help from China in lessening the threat from North Korea or reunification of that peninsula?
As I say also in the book, that we have similar interests in having a non-nuclear peninsula and dialogue towards that end. I just say that relative priority, given that this is North Korea is on the border with China, that it's had historically an alliance, though a very tense relationship with North Korea, that it views that issue of stability on the peninsula as paramount, and that refugee flows that might occur if there's instability, there are hundreds of thousands or tens or hundreds of thousands of Koreans, Korean refugees in northeast China. That's the area where most of the civic unrest is actually occurring. It's a very troublesome area for China. So the United States kind of taking a more aggressive posture to North Korea, which was originally what got China involved in this, was concerned about America doing something akin to what we did in Iraq on its border, got China in the middle of this and playing a host role for the six-party talks. I don't want to suggest that China doesn't want to see a non-nuclear peninsula. It does. But above all, it views the stability of its northeast periphery as paramount because of all the internal issues that we've discussed of stability. The United States, meanwhile, views the Korean issue as a regional, not global, problem of non-proliferation. That if they get a nuclear weapon, they can certainly threaten Japan, they can threaten the United States with the right missile capability. Of course, there are other rogue elements, rogue actions of drug trafficking and counterfeiting that we're involved, that North Korea is involved in. All these things we care mostly about. The Chinese don't particularly have as much concern about that. So to this point, we've had a similar process of dialogue, of commitment to dialogue. The question, though, with China is what happens if dialogue fails? And we're getting to that point where North Korea is not coming back to the six-party talks. So what happens then? What's plan B? And that's where the divisions, this fundamental division, come to light. And we're not sure what China will do at that point. They want to avoid that at all costs. So I think they want to at least bring North Korea back to the table, even if there's no progress. At least seem like this dialogue is proceeding, this process keeps going. Because if North Korea does not, we say, listen, you don't tolerate nuclear weapons in North Korea. That's your policy, not tolerate. What are you willing to do now to not tolerate it? Because they have it, they're not willing to talk about getting rid of it. So it's a very, very complex situation. But I think from all indications, China has a different priority interest than we do. We, of course, are concerned about stability in the peninsula as well, but less so about that.
Mm-hmm.
the fact of North Korea having a nuclear either a nuclear weapon or nuclear material that they can sell to the highest bidder, which they tend to do when they need capital, if they're isolated. And the highest bidders nowadays are folks that are quite a threat to the United States. So this is an issue of great concern to us as a global matter. To China, like most things, it's about its internal situation.
You spoke of the lack of recourse for intellectual property. As more and more companies become assemblers of the products in China, and China is more technically savvy to be able to reverse engineer some of the trickier components, what do you think the trends will be in the future in terms of recourse? And what might that mean for technology companies at large?
Well, we do have a whole section of the book that deals with China's kind of technological trajectory, how rapidly they're moving up the ladder in terms of technology, what their role is likely to be. I think in general the view we express is that China is still primarily at the low end, as Fred was saying, of labor-intensive assembly. The products look a lot more sophisticated. Instead of buying mostly shoes and apparel from China, we are now buying mostly computers, PCs, and particularly laptops. China's now far and away the globe's largest producer of notebook computers. But as Fred said, a huge portion of the value of those computers is actually imported parts and components, and really what China's doing is adding the labor to assemble it relatively efficiently, and then selling them into the global market. So the products look like they're moving rapidly up the ladder. Indeed, they're moving up a little bit, but they're still pretty much at the labor-intensive end of most manufacturing. And that, quite frankly, is not surprising because most of the companies that are doing this are foreign companies. They have no interest in moving up the ladder prematurely because it would probably reduce their profits. Now, as to the broader, longer-term question, I think the environment for IPR in China is going to change. It's going to improve gradually over time, largely because of an indigenous demand for protection and largely because key elements in the leadership understand that if China is to move away over time from simply being an assembler, that it's going to have to provide more protection for intellectual property. We go through the numbers, what's happened in terms of the number of trademarks registered, how it's just exploded over time. China's now among the top 10 patenting countries, and most of the cases that are being considered in China, whether it's in the court system or an IPR issue, or whether it's through administrative disputes about trademarks, involve Chinese companies suing other Chinese companies or Chinese companies asserting that other Chinese companies have violated the trademark that they previously registered. So we're beginning to see an indigenous demand for protection of intellectual property, and the people at the very top of the system understand the technology has to be protected. And if China is to become a more sophisticated modern economy. So I think there will be progress gradually over time. I think at the end of the day, if intellectual property is a them versus us issue, it's very hard to make progress. But hopefully what we're seeing in China is the beginning of this indigenous demand for protection, which I think will over time lead to a better situation.
Good question.
My name is Jeremy Fu. I'm the China Times of Taiwan. There's been quite a bit of bickering over the nature of Mr. Hu Jintao's visit. China calls it a state visit, whereas the U.S. insists it's just a visit. Of course, he will get 21 gun salute. My question is this a reflection of the U.S. dissatisfaction with China's handling on the trade and economic issues? This is my first question. Second question, I'll stick with the first one.
Right. This administration doesn't seem to like state visits very much generally, it seems to me, as well. I mean, we only had about four or five, I think, altogether, right? I mean, there haven't been many state dinners, and the president doesn't like to do them. They've been very, very close friends, allies. India, which is a neighbor. But China is just, they don't want to make it seem like China is one of those partners, like an ally, like a strategic partner. We have, this president puts a huge stake in values and democracy here in the also came in wary of the rhetoric of strategic partnership and giving China too much face that the Clinton administration did. And to have a state visit might be giving too much in public regard to a relationship that really is rather, use the word again, complex. It's when we have a lot of issues that we're at odds over, and that, frankly, in the upcoming summit, we're not going to get much satisfaction. So to give China what it wants when we're not getting anything that we want, which, you know, we give them the symbolism that they crave, and we get nothing on the substance that we crave, I think is a bridge too far for the administration. But they did compromise in the sense that they are allowing China to call it what they want to call it. I'm not sure how many guns salute, you know, it's going to be 19 or 21 or whatever it's going to be. Some reports have said it's going to be 21 guns. So they're going through and then giving a lunch instead of a dinner. So they're compromising to some degree, recognizing that face matters and symbolism does matter, but they don't want to cross over and give in too much on something, because for China, symbolism matters, but for the U.S. as well, I think symbolism matters. And I don't think we feel right now for public consumption, and even for practical consumption, we want to give in on something like this in the context of the way state visits with the U.S. administration.
You just mentioned the word complex. To describe the relationship between the U.S. and China. Of course, it's widely used by people from the president on down. But is there any other catchword, for the other gentleman as well, to describe this rather important relationship?
I mean, I would use the term interdependent, but I don't think that's not a political term that you're likely to hear from Congress or from the administration. But I think it's one that, being someone outside of the government who's trying to help Americans understand the facts of our relationship with China, that term has to be used. And we're entering an uncomfortable phase, I think, for U.S.-China relations. To the degree that we become more interdependent, or to put it a little bit more crisply, the degree to which we become more dependent upon China, a country that does not share our political values, this is going to be an uncomfortable and awkward, and increasingly so, situation for the United States and China. But part of the work we're trying to do in this book is prepare Americans for this future.
Just to carry that one step farther, as we at our Institute for International Economics work extensively on the international imbalances, where I've stressed U.S. and China are, to some extent, mirror images. We use the term codependency. China is dependent on the U.S. export market for a lot of job creation, a lot of development. The U.S. is dependent on China for a lot of low-cost, high-quality imports that keep our inflation rate down and our standard of living up. We're also reliant on China for a lot of investment in the U.S. to help keep our interest rates down and keeps the financing of our current account deficit going. In fact, one might say, well, what's wrong with all that? Sounds kind of good for both. The problem is, it can't last. It's not sustainable. It's like the U.S. said, drawing on your credit card as long as nobody demands that you pay off your balance. And it's fun as long as it lasts, but it doesn't last forever. And you know that. And you know that in this international financial domain from previous episodes. But there is a kind of codependency that's grown up. These are two of the world's three largest trading countries. We don't save at all, and they save a lot. They don't consume much, and we consume a lot. We don't produce so much anymore, and they produce a lot. We borrow, and they lend. So there's a lot of codependency, and unraveling it in a stable way, in a way that avoids breaking crockery, is very important. And that's why we are calling on both countries to take constructive action to preempt crisis. Else, we know from history, inevitably there will be crisis, and it will be big dust-ups. And in the first instance, it could be a crisis in the trading system with the outbreak of trade protectionism in this country, directed against China in particular, perhaps Asia more broadly, because these imbalances keep getting bigger and bigger and have more and more noticeable adverse effects within our own economy. So it's a difficult dynamic because of the short-run benefits to both sides, the codependency, but at the same time, the
longer run unsustainability of it, and the question of whether you take sensible and constructive preemptive policy action to achieve the adjustment in an orderly way, or whether you wait for the deluge. All too often, governments do the latter, and then you get lots of crockery broken, big, big costs, in this case, on both sides of the equation.
And the fact is, just to complete this thought, there's no one word that's going to encapsulate the U.S.-China relationship, and that's sort of what the book is about. Because there is going to be a degree of rivalry, and there's going to be a degree of partnership. We are challenging China, and China, I think China challenges us through the senior dialogue with Bob Zelik to be partners. You know, we want to talk about things, understand the perspectives, reduce the mistrust. But there are some structural issues on the economic side and the security side that are going to be difficult for the two sides as we look forward. There are going to be a rising power, and we are, you know, a risen power. So there are some things that are just fundamentally difficult to predict in the future. And no one word is going to ever capture a relationship as complex as this one. And I think it's going to be the issue for 10, 15, 20 years or more to come. And I think that's what we would like people to read the book for, is because there's a thirst, I think, for understanding what exactly the issue of rising China means for Americans. Because some people do have an image of, oh, this big shadow, this big threat coming. I think most people tend to feel that doesn't feel quite right. This isn't the Soviet Union. Something different happening here. I want to understand it better. I think, you know, we're one of many, I think, trying to.
If I may, one more. You just mentioned that China's challenge to the United States. But in today's New York Times, the front page story said that in private conversations between the president and Mr. Hu, Mr. Hu said he's got just huge problems domestically to be able to really challenge the United States. I think the point that he was trying to make, the U.S., China is not a threat, nor is it intent to challenge the United States in the world. So do you agree with that? Do you think that's true?
We've discussed this a little bit earlier, but let me just say one thing. When the Chinese have come to me, scholars and all, saying, listen, we're not looking to change the international system. We're only focused on ourselves. That also worries me, and that's what we discuss in the book. I think the kind of desperate selfishness that they need to keep that economy running, to keep it going, to keep the stability, has external effects. And this isn't the rise of Luxembourg. This is the rise of China. You know, and what they do, just anything they do, on the international trading system, on energy resources, on military modernization, has an effect on the international system. Just, it has to. And that's why Zelik, I think, is saying, you can't avoid the responsibility of being China. That, yes, it may not be your intent, but in reality, it will cause changes. It will cause challenges. And what we need to do is deal with this transition in a way that creates stability, and that we don't overreact, but we also, each side, do its part to make sure the relationship and our position in the world remains stabilized.
Yeah, this goes back again to what I was saying on the economic side. China has a huge stake in the maintenance of an open global trading system and the maintenance of international financial stability. Yet they have become so big and such a big player in that. Their own policies are, to some extent, putting all that at risk, that what we're looking for is for them to assume that responsible stakeholder role by playing a constructive role, not mainly because of the bilateral trade deficit with the U.S. or even the bilateral issue with the U.S. as a whole, but because of the global impact that they increasingly have. And it's tough for any rising power. Rising power raises two problems. One is for the rest of the world to accept it, but the other is for the rising power to understand it's a rising power and that it has an impact on everybody else. And it has to take into account its effect on others and the feedback from the others to itself in fashioning its own policy. I worked with Japan for 30 years, and I don't think Japan yet quite got it, how important it became to the world economy for a prolonged period of time. A lot of disruption and undermining of the global trading system resulted. I once said to Premier Wen Jiabao, please don't make the same mistakes that Japan made for 25 years. thought maybe that would no sales so far. But I think that is true. China has to recognize its responsibility as the U.S., as the rest of the world, including the U.S., has to accept its greater role. There's several references to Bob Zelik. I should just mention, in case you didn't get that announcement Friday afternoon or this morning, that Zelik is going to be speaking at my Institute for International Economics in a little over an hour, between 12 and 12:30, to kind of lay out the administration's strategy for the visit of President Hu Jintao. We're going to talk more in depth about the economic side of the book, too, but I think the feature will be Deputy Secretary Zelik. I just want to make sure people knew that in case you want to take that in.
We have time for a couple more.
Eric McVeighton, the Institute of Foreign Policy Analysis. I just left Shanghai after a week there on my own boat, not with IFPA. And among other things, I had the book with me, and I have to say as a compliment to you folks that I met with some of the pretty sophisticated people there in Shanghai, and I was happy to, I would be happy to share what you wrote with some of those people who know a little bit about their own country. So I thought your book stood up in that circumstance. It's kind of a cute thing for me to be opening it, reading it, and attending seminars with those guys and so forth. So I think it stood that test. I unexpectedly met for a long time with a party official. And the question of what we're doing with respect to Taiwan came up. And I found myself saying, you know, we have some limits on just how far we feel comfortable pushing Chen Shui-bian the way that you tell us you have limits on the way you want to push North Korea. I don't know how I said, that's an imperfect analogy, but of course I found myself at 3 hours into the meeting grasping for ways to move on to something else. I wonder how that analogy strikes you, but something else struck me here as I was listening to the earlier conversation with respect to corruption. I think I saw new levels of subtlety in the corruption situation in China, and interested in whether others may have seen it as well. With respect to business operations, including even personal consumer things and so forth, I found that, and I think over the years I found that no longer do you have to make some special deal in order to be able to buy something. In other words, they sell it to you, and they sell it to you at a good price, and they're damn glad to do it, and you get good service and all these kinds of things, and that's generally the situation. However, I went to a traditional hospital just for the experience of doing it and so forth, and I saw that money with my escort passed hands. I wasn't supposed to see it. So you know that this sort of thing happens. But more subtly, the party and the person of this fellow I met wanted to do all sorts of things for me because, of course, he thought wrongly that I could somehow influence the summit and all those kinds of situations. And Derek, I also noted one other thing that I wonder about how it's developing, the transparency issue. I noticed questions among them as to how prudent it would be for President Hu Jintao to say, we are doing the following for modernization of the PLA, and our intentions are, as to whether that is a prudent course of action or not. And let me ask Fred, is there room that you think for the next session, if people want to go over there? Do you know whether your place is full?
It's full, but if you're willing to stand in the back, you can come.
Okay. Anyway, I offer those reflections on my recent week in Shanghai.
I'll just take on just a couple of the North Korea one I've noticed as well. The interesting parallel.
By the way, at least stopped him.
Yeah.
He was taken aback. Yeah, he did.
I think I saw one of the crawls under one of the cable stations that said, China urges the United States to engage without preconditions in dialogue with North Korea. And I thought to myself, as someone who follows Taiwan, it's exactly what we say to the Chinese about Taiwan. You know, engage without preconditions, reduce mistrust, reduce the sense of military threat, and deal with them on those terms. There's no irony in China and Beijing on the issue, and they just don't listen. But there clearly is a somewhat parallel in that regard. So I do take your point regarding sort of Taiwan. On the issue of military transparency, it is something that we really like to know everything the Chinese military is doing, and the Chinese military is not going to tell us. But there are certain areas where I think we would like to have greater transparency. Number one would be the budget. There are concerns that the budget did spending on things and what line items they're spending particularly on. They're getting better in transparency year by year, as you know, with their white papers that they put out every other year. It gets better and better at what they're showing. They're providing greater access for American visitors to various sites in China. This is something the Chinese are going to go very, very slowly, and we're going to continue to make it a theme. But it's not a showstopper, I think, in the relationship. Overall, the military-to-military relationship is moving rather slowly and fitfully. And we're just going to be concerned with, if they show us everything, we're going to be concerned. If they don't show us everything, we're going to be concerned. Because simply the military development is something we need to watch, given the size and nature of the country.
Bates, I mean, one of the points was Falun Gong. If I could somehow come back here and convince the American people how bad Falun Gong is, all sorts of rewards. I mean, that was the. I thought that's a new subtlety.
Well, subtle like a train wreck, I would say. It strikes me as very interesting because it just underscores yet again, I think, the degree to which the Chinese leadership have a lot of concerns about what's going on domestically, socially, politically, economically, and it consumes their attention to a huge degree, and that's why we need to pay a lot more attention to it. Because if we can understand better what they're thinking about, that may even create various forms of leverage and common cause in some cases that would be helpful for U.S. interests.
I'd like to thank our authors, Fred Bergsten, Bates Gill, Nicholas Lardy, and Derek Mitchell for a fascinating presentation today. This book is really designed to go beyond the Hu Jintao visit this week. As you'll see, it's designed to inform policymakers, scholars, and the business community for years to come. You can find more information at ChinaBalanceSheet.org, and the book, as of today, will be in bookstores everywhere. Thank you for coming.